Hi, I'm Anthony Romero. I'm the National Executive Director of the ACLU. I want to thank you all for joining us for our post-election town hall. This is our largest audience yet. We only invited 4 million of our closest friends and supporters and activists and social media followers. We had an amazing number of RSVPs, over 800 questions sent in beforehand, which we're going to get to. And you know, clearly the card-carrying members of the ACLU are awake, they're paying attention, even if you're a bit sleep-deprived, and maybe we're beginning to exhale a bit. So let me do some disclaimers up front. This town hall is off the record. If there are journalists among us, nothing that gets said here is for attribution or citation. I also want to be clear up front that the ACLU is a nonpartisan organization. We did not endorse Joe Biden. We did not oppose Donald Trump. That is not who we are as an institution. But just because we didn't pick a candidate doesn't mean that we didn't have skin in this game. And before we delve into the election, I just want to offer some of my personal reflections from the cockpit. So today we're turning a page of sorts. We're turning a page from one of the most darkest and most challenging moments in civil rights and civil liberties. Over the last 4 years, we've weathered an all-out attack on our basic freedoms. We fought off an all-out assault on immigrants' rights. We withstood the racist dog whistles as loud as bullhorns. We witnessed presidential backslapping of white supremacists. And for his anti-civil rights and civil liberties agenda, Donald Trump is being democratically removed from the Oval Office by his employer, the American people. And our nation's election system has withstood record turnout. It has withstood an avalanche of mail-in ballots in the middle of a pandemic. And we have withstood the attacks of a president who would rather tear down democratic norms and institutions than admit that he is a loser in a national election. And the election may have been slow, at times excruciating, but democracy in the end worked as it should have, with every vote being counted. And the people will choose their leader rather than the leaders choosing the voters. And we have you all to thank for helping us play our part. We brought over 450 legal actions against the Trump administration, all in. In the last 7 months, we have filed 33 voting rights lawsuits to protect the right to vote. And you'll be hearing today from Dale Ho, the director of our Voting Rights Project in a second, who will talk to us about how we see that litigation playing out now and what stands in the balance as we count up these final votes in the national election. Over the last year, we prepared our battleground states, and you all will be amazed and thrilled to meet the leaders we have in our battleground affiliates in Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, North Carolina, Wisconsin. We've been meeting as a group 4 times a day. The last call is at 10 p.m., and we want to make sure we share with you some of our own perspectives folks on the front line. Only the ACLU has boots on the ground in each and every single state. And so we have a unique ability to jump in and track the issues and intervene in any litigation when necessary. We also mobilize our membership. And you'll hear from the head of our organizing department. You'll also hear from the head of our political department what policy plans and proposals we have at the ready. But we could not have done any of this without your help and support. So I just want you all, those of you who joined in with us, to just sit back, drop the shoulders, absorb a bit of the sincere appreciation and the gratitude that we have for you on behalf of our clients, on behalf of the communities, on behalf of the issues and constituents we are privileged to serve. We want to thank you for helping make their lives better because of your belief in us. All right. So let me invite now one of my colleagues and heroes to join me on this Zoom stage, Dale Ho, the director of our Voting Rights project. Dale, are you with me now?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you, Anthony.
All right, there, I see you. I see you. I was just looking for you. Okay, so we've gotten a bunch of questions for you, and you are the one who's going to help my folks sleep better at night today. But I wonder if you could start out with answering this one question. When will this end? Right, is from Carolyn from Seattle, Washington. And then another one asks, how long is eternity? So tell us where you see the litigation, the state of play, these lawsuits that have been filed across the country by the GOP, by the Trump administration. Give us your read about where we stand and how things are going and how you see things from where you are.
Those are great questions. How long is eternity would probably take us an eternity to unpack. But as for how long the count's going to go, it depends. I know elections workers are working as fast as they can to try to count every ballot. The most important thing is that they get the count right, not that necessarily that they get it fast. So they're going to take the time that they need to make sure that they've got it right. Now, we knew for months that we were going to be in this situation for two simple reasons. One, we have a record number of absentee ballots being cast this year, primarily due to concerns about health and safety with the COVID-19 pandemic going on. But second, and maybe this is, you know, less well known, I think a lot of people here probably do appreciate this fact, but maybe not everyone knows it. The states that were described as pivotal in the 2016 presidential election, that industrial kind of northeastern band of states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, those three states do not permit the processing of absentee ballots until, in Michigan's case, the day before Election Day, and in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania's case, Election Day or even Election Night. That's different from what a lot of other states do. Florida and Ohio, for example, permit the processing of absentee ballots on a rolling basis, you know, several weeks before the election. And that's why we were able to get the tallies in those states in on election night and be able to forecast the winners of those states on election night. It took longer in Michigan and Wisconsin, and it's still happening in Pennsylvania, although I think there are high hopes that enough of the vote will be counted in Pennsylvania by today that it may be possible to forecast a winner. But when we looked at this situation months ago, we knew that we had to prepare for two things. One, we had to prepare for possible efforts to interfere with the full count of the ballots in those states, because we knew it was going to stretch beyond election night and that that would create opportunities for malfeasance. And second, we knew we had to prepare for efforts to disqualify large number of ballots. Right. Every vote counts. And we just wanted to make sure that elections officials were able to count every vote. Okay. So we pre-drafted papers to deal with both of these situations, efforts to stop elections administrators from doing their jobs and making sure that we have a full and accurate count. And we almost had to use those papers and rush into court in Michigan when a few days ago, a crowd was threatening to break down the doors at a vote counting center in Detroit. We were actually minutes away from filing a lawsuit under the Ku Klux Klan Act when the crowd dispersed. So fortunately, we didn't have to rush into court on that, but we stood ready to do it and we continue to. The second thing, and this is something we're still watching at for very closely, are efforts to disqualify large numbers of ballots. And there already have been a few lawsuits filed that seek to do that. The good news is that we do not see, as of now, any cases that could threaten to disqualify a large enough number of ballots that could plausibly put the anticipated outcome of any state into doubt, let alone enough states that would destabilize the results of the presidential election. So we feel good about the current state of play with litigation right now. Some of these cases are going to go forward. Some cases, like a case in Pennsylvania about ballots that arrived after Election Day that haven't even been counted yet and are not even a part of the official count yet, may go up to the United States Supreme Court even. That's possible. but we're not worried about, right now anyway, whether or not the outcome of any of those cases could plausibly change where we expect to be in Pennsylvania or in any other state.
Okay, I want to come back to that, because that is the line that's going to help people sleep better than anything they have in their medicine cabinet, that last statement you just made. But let me make sure we unpack it for our friends, because you know, you and I have been living this over the last several months. You know, we have filed 31 lawsuits to expand the right to vote before Election Day. Since and around Election Day, we had two additional votes. We had one in Texas on the drive-through voting, right? We intervened on that our colleagues in Texas argued. And there was one other case in North Carolina, right, around the protesters. March to the polls, right? When you say we got ready, break it down for folks who are not the lawyers. I only play a lawyer on TV. I have a whole bunch of stuff that you've sent me on my hard drive, right? But you literally walk them through the draft pleadings state by state, because each state has different election laws. And so you can't just have one model complaint, you know, for the whole country. You have to literally go state by state. And walk us through how you prepared for what could be the eventualities that you were ready for this week.
Well, we looking, you know, going back to the beginning of this year, we tried to prepare for the election in really three phases. And I talked a little bit about the after election phase, the protecting the vote counting process and protecting the ballots from being disqualified. But before that phase, which is really the end game, we looked at preparing for the 2020 election in two phases. The first was preparing the rules for the election, trying to clear the way for as many voters to register and cast a ballot safely as possible. And then the second was protecting voters once voting began during early voting and on Election Day. So let me talk about the first one, clearing the way for voters as much as possible. When the pandemic hit, we knew we were in for a really wild ride. It's always a challenge fighting back against voter suppression. It's always been that way in every federal election since I became director of the Voting Rights Project back in 2013. But when COVID hit, we knew we were really in for it. You saw what happened during the primaries with major disruptions, postponed elections, closed polling places, extremely long lines. And we were wondering if we were going to even be able to have a safe election at all back in March and April. The way we saw it, there were at least two major issues. The first was, what is this going to do, the pandemic, I mean, to voter registration? Because normally the summer and fall before presidential election year is a huge time to get new voters registered through voter registration drives at the DMV, but no voter registration drives were happening because people were largely staying at home and not going out, and DMVs were closed. So what were we going to do about that? And then the second thing we were worried about was, how are we going to actually protect people's health and safety when they want to cast their ballots? You know, back at the beginning of the pandemic, we didn't know how bad it was going to get, whether or not there were going to be quarantines. We wanted to make sure that people could vote safely, remotely, if that's what they wanted to do, by mail. So we looked at these two issues, and we filed a wave of lawsuits around the country and investigations. Ultimately, we won 26 victories in 19 states, home to 154 million people, states that wield 247 votes collectively in the Electoral College. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. On voter registration, we conducted investigations in five states for those states of failure to provide voter registration services as required under federal law. I'll mention two of those five states in particular. In Arizona, we learned that voters who were changing their address at the DMV were not getting voter registration services as required under the motor voter law. And as a result of our work there, the state mailed 450,000 voter registration applications to people who should have gotten them when they were doing business with the DMV. In Michigan, 345,000 Medicaid recipients were mailed voter registration applications when we learned that the state had not provided those voter registration services as required by law. And, you know, that's obviously a critical, critical issue for people on public assistance right now, given the economic fallout of the pandemic. So we tried to make sure that we could fill the gap that was being created in voter registration due to the pandemic.
So walk me through, and then I'm gonna take off my sweater because apparently my sweater is hitting this microphone. So I'm gonna kind of mute myself and you'll see me just rolled a bit on camera, but they'll be distracted. Listen to Dale. Walk us through how many lawsuits have been filed by the GOP and by the Trump administration, right, thus far. You have looked at each and every single one of them. You've given me a tutorial on each one of them. Talk about the merits or the lack of merits that you have seen in this litigation. Help people, like, for instance, Margot from Gig Harbor, Washington, wants to know how many challenges have been filed. Dennis from Fort Myers, what's the likelihood they end up before the Supreme Court? Nathan from Woodside wanted to know, what factors do you bring in determining which battles you jump into and which ones you don't? Kathy from St. Paul asks, if Biden wins, are there legal avenues to dispute the result, right? All of these questions tied into, you know, folks don't know the litigation the way you do. So walk them through why they can sleep as soundly as I slept last night when you and I talked at 11 p.m.
Right now, and this is the top line, I think, takeaway that people need to have. Right now, in terms of the lawsuits that have been filed since voting began to try to affect the voting, the vote counting process, there are, you know, maybe about half, between half a dozen to 10 of these lawsuits in some states like Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Right now, we do not view any of those lawsuits as plausibly affecting the number of a large enough number of votes that they could throw the outcome of any individual state into question, or enough states that could throw the outcome of the election overall into question, given what the projections indicate where we expect those states to land. So that's the big takeaway. Right now, we're not particularly concerned about the litigation that's been filed. But let me tell you about what these lawsuits look like. There are basically two types of lawsuits that have been filed by the Trump campaign so far. First, there have been challenges to the way that votes have been counted. And really, these are very, very, you know, basic cases about the procedures for vote counting and whether or not enough poll watchers, elections observers from the campaigns have been permitted to watch the vote counting process. No one has in any of these cases alleged that there's been anything illegal or problematic with the vote count itself or with any of the votes themselves. Just some arguments that the campaigns have not been able to get enough personnel into the buildings in order to watch vote counting. Most of these lawsuits have been dismissed right away. There was one in Michigan that was kind of laughed out of court, another one in Georgia that was also laughed out of court because the Trump campaign couldn't even identify specific individuals who had been unfairly excluded from a vote counting location. There was one case in Pennsylvania where, you know, a court ordered more permission for people to come in and to stand closer to the people who were conducting the count. But again, these lawsuits don't really make any difference in terms of the number of ballots that are going to be accepted and included as part of the vote count. It's okay. Just about procedure of the vote counting process.
I'm going to give out your cell phone at the end of this town hall. So if any of our folks can't sleep well at night, they can call you. They've been, a bunch of them have been texting me, and I've been asking you to corroborate, but don't go far, Dale, because I might bring you back to talk about some of the litigation in some of the specific states. But I want to thank you very, very much, Dale. And you know, that's the caliber of lawyer you've got standing watch over voting rights. Luckily, he doesn't do it alone. And with offices in each and every single state, we have been especially focused on building out the capacity and backing up the amazing leaders we have in these battleground states. And no one better than Andrea Young. Andrea Young, one of my dear friends and heroes in Georgia. Come join me on the Zoom stage. Hello, how are you? You don't look any worse for the wear. You look great. I love Georgia on my mind.
I started feeling better about 4 a.m. this morning.
Oh God, let me tell you, I love Georgia, love Georgia. So walk us through, where do the ballots stand right now? Talk to me about the work you've done around this election.
Yes.
The nonpartisan work.
Yes.
Right? Well, when I express an opinion, it's my personal opinion, not the ACLU opinion. So talk to us about what.
Here's the thing. When I started as ACLU executive director in Georgia, voter suppression was my primary focus for 4 years. So the 1 million votes that were cast this year, 1 million more than in 2018, is because we have been successful working with Dale and his team. We have been successful at making it easier for people, for everyone who wants to vote, to be able to vote and cast an informed ballot. So right now in the state of Georgia, over 1 million people have voted more than voted in 2018. Over about 1.3 million voted by mail. And that's what you see that's taking the time for the count. And there are about 8,000 votes left to count that we know about. And until 5 o'clock today, any military ballot that comes in will also be counted. So citizens, volunteers, poll workers, someone called them first responders for democracy, are counting these ballots in counties across the state. And, we really feel this is the fruition for us of 4 years of relentless effort to eliminate voter suppression in all of its forms.
Yeah. One of the things that we issued earlier last week with Andrea's help, but also the leadership of our data analytics project, was looking at the disproportionate impact on communities of color if you tried to just cut off the mail-in votes.
Yeah.
Because that's where how many of the Black and brown communities were voting. Andrea, give us a sense. You have a question here from Doug in Cincinnati. If there is a state recount, who is allowed to participate in the recount? Are there party delegations? Are they nonpartisan? Walk folks through it, because everyone knows that this is a very tight race in Georgia. So they want to know what's coming next around the corner. And then also, can you tie in a little bit about what, I guess there's a woman from Omega, from McDonough, Georgia, wants to know, what can we do as Georgia residents to help ensure fair maps in 2021, who's already thinking around the corner?
Yes, well, the fair maps are really, really important. And one of the reasons that even though we got, there was certainly a 50-50 split in terms of however, the statewide race comes out, you don't see that difference reflected in the legislature. And so many of the African-Americans who ran for legislature were not successful because of gerrymandering. Our focus has been on, implementing the Voting Rights Act. That's what our affiliate started doing 60 years ago in Georgia. That's what we continue to do. The effect of not counting, of cutting off any ballots for African Americans, I think our analytics department said 39% of African Americans were planning to vote by mail because of the effect that COVID-19 especially has had on our community. It's been devastating in the Black community in Georgia and the brown community in Georgia. So Anthony, I'm like you a little bit. I play a lawyer on TV. And so, the recount issue is one that we, my team and Dale's team are like parsing right now to say exactly what is that process going to look like and, how are we going to how are we going to play it? Frankly, I feel like that is, in many respects, that's something for the parties.
Yeah.
We are nonpartisan. We made it possible for
people
almost 5 million people to vote in the state of Georgia. And so, that we feel like we've really, and for Black voters to have their voice heard. Mm-hmm.
We are so lucky that you're there. Yeah. Walk us through, Andrea, because one of the things I've been impressed by is that not just the litigation that you've brought to expand the right to the franchise, but also the way in which you've engaged in community outreach, the work around poll workers, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Where, walk them through what you did at the ACLU of Georgia to make sure that there were proper poll workers to administer these votes.
So one of the things that's so, helpful about the sustained support we get from so many of you is it allows us to plan. We have been planning this for 2 years after we saw what happened in 2018, the many ways that Black voters were frustrated in trying to have their voices heard. So we began to monitor boards of elections We recruited ACLU volunteers to go to Board of Election meetings and make sure they weren't closing polls in Black communities. They weren't making it more difficult. When we saw the debacle that happened in June, where the lines you saw in the state of Georgia that made international news, we built on that framework to say we can recruit poll workers. We have the relationships with the counties, with the boards of elections. So we recruited over 2,500 people to serve as poll workers. We had an ACLU volunteer in every single poll in Fulton County. We also had them in some of the surrounding counties that you've heard about in the news that are dominated by African Americans. And our materials were so good that the county boards of election people were saying, go to the ACLU website and look at their training materials so that you can feel confident that you know what to do. We even had some staff and interns and board members and donors that stepped up to be poll workers. So this is a statewide program. We feel we have created a systemic change now in the state of Georgia. Lawyers get CLE credit for being poll workers. So we think this is going to be an ongoing change.
That's great. We want to thank you, Andrea. You're great. You're amazing. You inspire me. What you do is just, it's fantastic in one of our strongest offices. I'm going to switch gears because there's a lot of ground to cover. So forgive me for running. Okay. We're going to go now to Holly Wellborn, my colleague and my hero in Nevada. Holly, where are you? There you are. Where are you? I'm looking for you. I think they're bringing you up. They're on a Zoom grid. Holly Wellborn. Come out wherever you are. Just stick with me for a second. I think if you wave your hand on the Zoom, Holly, so that he can see which one you are in the back room. She's got the We the People sign. There you are. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ethan. Thank you, colleagues. Hello, Holly. You look well.
Thank you.
You've been keeping me up at night. Your state has been keeping me up at night. They keep telling me we got a tranche of votes to dump on. And then I stay up and I kind of set my alarm and I wake up and there ain't nothing. So walk me through where we are in Nevada right now. Where do the ballots stand? What is the ACLU of Nevada keeping an eye out for? And, you know, talk to me about this registrar of yours, because I just think he's become a kind of a national sensation. So talk to us about what's playing out in Nevada. What are you looking at and what's happening with your registrar?
Lots of exciting things going on here in Nevada. And we're doing this deliberately to keep everyone on their toes because everyone says our state name incorrectly. So it's completely deliberate. Just kidding. But right now, the state of play here in Nevada, there's about 131,000 ballots that need to be counted. And those are 90% in Clark County. Clark County is our most populous county in the state with about 2.2 million people. So it's incredibly diverse. And it's mostly mail ballots that we're waiting to count. There are some provisional ballots. About 44,000 of those are same day registrations that have to be counted. They have to verify who those individuals are. But I do think that we'll start seeing progress, start seeing some changes as soon as all of these votes are counted. And that's really what we're focused on here. Registrar Gloria at the Clark County Elections Department, he has been hard at work ensuring that this whole slew of new laws that have passed in Nevada, such as automatic voter registration, same day voter registration, all of those require, you know, new administrative procedures in order to maintain the integrity of the election. And that is what he's doing. And that is why the count is taking a while, not to mention the fact that back in August during a special session, we extended mail ballots to every active voter in the state of Nevada. And those are being counted at this time. So that's the first time we've had this volume of mail. So he's doing a great job. He's doing a meticulous job at ensuring that every count votes and that every count is voted accurate, or is that every vote is counted accurately.
Yeah, that's great. Walk us through, and then I'm gonna switch gears. Walk us through the ballot referenda in 2018 and the legislative win in 2019 that really expanded the right to the franchise. Because we had a big role in both efforts. again, for us, it's about expanding the right to vote. It's not deciding who gets elected, but we try to expand the right to vote so that more people can participate in the political process. And walk us through what happened in 2018, 2019, that the ACLU Nevada was into it.
We have had tremendous success in the state. Automatic voter registration was projected to register about 200,000 new voters in its first year of implementation. That was slowed slightly by the COVID-19 pandemic, but we saw in January and February of this year that 20,000 new voters registered in each month. So we expect for that to go up. But that ballot initiative passed by with 60% support, overwhelming support of Nevada voters. So that way people can vote during DMV transactions. We'll skip, you know, all of this different paperwork. You just come into the DMV, you register to vote, and you're done, and you're on the voter rolls. Also helps with updating address, et cetera, to expand the right to vote and to get through that red tape that keeps people from getting on the voter rolls. We also supported a large voting rights bill in 2019 that created same-day voter registration. It also expanded polling locations in Indigenous communities. We're incredibly proud of that. We're seeing right now that turnout in Indigenous communities is at about 90% in every place where there is a polling location. And right now with same day voter registration, 44,000 people have utilized it. That is an amazing win. And that is legislation that we supported and that we backed up. And we are seeing that resonate in the election today.
That's the point to make to our colleagues. I mean, one of the things you have the benefit from when you have people on the ground in each and every single state full time, you know, we don't pick up our marbles and go home when an election is done. We're in those states all the time. So we can play a long game so that we can pass a ballot referendum in 2018 and a legislative proposal in 2019 that then serves up the type of conditions for an expansion of voting rights in 2020. You only get that by having people like Holly, who's on the ground year in, year out, all the time. If we just walked away from it saying, okay, New York and Washington lawyers can go back to New York and Washington on the off election year. No, that wouldn't get done. Thank you, Holly. I'll see you on the other, see you tonight at the Situation Room tonight. All right, now we're gonna go to Pennsylvania to Reginald Shuford. Reggie Shuford, come join me up here at the Zoom room. He's the you got him with the gray shirt. Reggie, you are a sight for sore eyes. How much I am so relieved that you are the head of the ACLU Pennsylvania. Walk me through where the ballots stand right now. I think, you know, obviously people, all eyes have been on Pennsylvania. And, you know, also talk me through a little bit about the impact of the murder of Walter Wallace on your city and the impact that you've seen on the election. So walk us through where we are right now and then pull the camera back a little bit and give me a little bit more of a perspective of what was played out in the last couple of weeks and the impact on the election.
Thank you, Anthony. I'm delighted to be here with everybody today, feeling very inspired, if exhausted. Andrea said she started feeling a little better about 4 o'clock. I think I started feeling a little better about maybe 9 o'clock this morning. So we're exhausted. Delighted but that the efforts that we've been making over many, many years to protect every eligible voter right to vote is actually paying off. So I think where things stand right now is that there are still 105 to 50,000 maybe votes to be counted in Pennsylvania, including some provisional ballots. With 40,000 of those or so, I think, in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Last I checked, Biden was up by just under 14,000 votes, and that continues to change. Obviously, we are nonpartisan. We just want everybody to be able to vote and to do so safely. The unfortunate and unnecessary murder of Walter Wallace certainly complicated things. You know, the city was already on edge, as it has been, frankly, all summer. And that senseless killing of Walter Wallace Jr. certainly did not help things. But I'm proud of my fellow Philadelphians. Yeah. They were able to maintain perspective. They were able to keep their eyes on the prize. They were able to walk and chew chewing gum at the same time. Yeah. And to appreciate the need for voting as well, right? As to protest against the killing of Walter Wallace Jr. So all of those things happen at the same time.
And I think your leadership had a lot to do with that. I mean, frankly, your ability to kind of get in front of the cameras, to sound a message both of the needed reforms and to be the leader of the ACLU at that time was critically important. And, you know, people voted like their rights depended upon it, quite literally. Let me invite Dale Ho to come back to the stage for a second while I ask up the second question. Talk to us about, you have a question from Dion from Reading, Pennsylvania, who wants to know, Reggie, whether you work with other organizations like the League of Women Voters, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And then when we get Dale Ho back on camera with us, I think the wrong one, I want to talk a little bit about the litigation in we want Reggie and Dale, Ethan, if you can have the three of us, because I don't want to lose Reggie. But Dale, while I have you. Oh, no, you got Victoria. That she's coming up next. She's Arizona. You see, we got a lot of people to cover. There we go. All right.
I'm happy.
What do you do with the League of Women Voters, with the LDF? And Dale, speak specifically about the litigation in Pennsylvania and the amicus you've just filed.
Great. So none of the work that we do in Pennsylvania is by ourselves. We work in active coalition with organizations like the League of Women Voters, Common Cause, you name it. We love it, right? We are able to leverage our particular expertise and resources and do what we do best, which is litigation that Dale can talk a little more about. But also we run a command center for every election that can receive calls about issues at voting precincts on the spot.
Right.
We have lawyers dispatched in every county who can show up in court. This year, we received 3,000 calls to our command center, and mostly there were very minor issues that we were able to get resolved. We ended up going to court just once on a language access case. But we work in coalition with a lot of organizations, but League of Women Voters in particular is a frequent plaintiff. So we represent them in a lot of our lawsuits. And Dale, I'll let you talk about the amicus brief that we filed last night.
Yeah, on the provisional ballots case. That was last night, Dale?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So I mentioned, I think I referred to last time I was talking about to two buckets of lawsuits. You have the lawsuits that the Trump campaign is filing about not being able to observe the ballot counting process. Those all seem kind of frivolous. Then there's a second bucket of lawsuits, and there are a number of these in Pennsylvania right now that are trying to actually disqualify certain ballots. The issue in the lawsuit that's moving right now is an issue about people who submitted an absentee ballot, so by mail or at a Dropbox, and then there was a technical problem with that ballot. They were notified of that. So something like wrong, signatures in the wrong place, or they wrote today's date where their birth date was supposed to be, or vice versa. Their ballot was dinged on that technicality. They were notified of that. And then they came in and cast a provisional ballot. Those provisional ballots have not been counted yet. So these are not ballots that are part of the voting totals that you're seeing right now, but the Trump campaign has sued to try to stop those ballots from being counted. Great. Now, we filed an amicus brief in that case last night.
What time was that you filed?
9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock last night. It's in state court. It'll move through the state court system. We'll see what the state court judge does. It's an important case because these are people's votes. It's people's voice. It's their right to be heard. But again, I want to assure people that as important as that is and as important as the work is to try to preserve those people's votes, it's not a part of the tally that you're seeing right now, and the outcome of that case isn't going to change the where we expect the final results to land in the presidential race in Pennsylvania.
Okay, great. Thank you both, gentlemen. Reggie, thank you very much. Dale, pick up your phone whenever I call you on the speed dial because I have questions for you throughout the weekend. Ethan, if we can move now to pick up some time, I'm going to go a little bit out of order. So I'd like you to pick up Victoria Lopez, my colleague from the ACLU of Arizona. And then I'd also like you to bring up to the stage for me Sharon Dolenti. So bring them both up at the same time so I can see if I can catch up some of the time I have. I talked too much at the beginning. But we have Victoria Lopez, who's my colleague from the ACLU of Arizona. And we have Sharon Dolenti, who is the voting rights strategist of the ACLU of Michigan. So the three of us could be able to be in conversation and community at the same time. That would be ideal. There we go. There we go. Victoria, hello. Sharon, hello.
Hello.
All right. Victoria Lopez, what's going on in Arizona? Walk me through what you're seeing in terms of the rallies and the protests, especially can you talk to us about what's playing out in terms of the rallies around Maricopa County? And there's a question that I think we wanted to make sure is what can people is there anything people can do to help support the work of the ACLU Arizona? And then Sharon Dolenti from the ACLU of Michigan, I want you to kind of talk again about the long game, the Prop 3 issue that I was raising up before about how you've been preparing for this moment. So Victoria, talk to us about what's going on in Arizona.
Yeah, thank you so much, Anthony. I'm so grateful to be here with all of you today. I really appreciate it, really appreciate the question. You know, like in many places across the country, we've seen just historic turnout in Arizona. We've got about 300,000 ballots in Arizona remain to be counted. 138,000 of those ballots in Maricopa County, the largest county in the state. We have seen some protests in front of the Maricopa County Elections Office by Trump supporters, by some Republican members of Congress. We have been, relying on our Secretary of State and our Maricopa County Recorder's Office to continue to do their job, continue to count those votes, and make sure that the voices of all Arizonans are heard. So we are, we are watching, like everybody across the country, waiting for those numbers to come in from Arizona. The next results will be reported this evening at 7 o'clock PM local time.
Right.
And we'll be watching with the rest of the country.
Great. Sharon, talk to us about a Proposition 3 or Question 3 and why we played that game 2 years ago that played out in Michigan this week.
Yeah, so in 2018, with the leadership primarily of the ACLU, but also in partnership with great collaborators here on the ground, Michigan passed the most aggressive package of voting rights reforms ever adopted through a statewide ballot initiative. It was resoundingly supported. 80 of 83 counties in Michigan voted for it. And it was a great victory in and of itself, but it was the last 2 years have been about fulfilling on the promise of that ballot initiative. At the time in 2018, we thought it would increase turnout by 200,000 or perhaps 400,000 at the top end. Our numbers as of our election on Tuesday is that we increased turnout from 2016 by more than 600,000. Michigan has seen more than 3 million people cast an absentee ballot. We didn't have that right. And we could have never known how important that would have been this year. But not just the voting by mail. Michigan had almost 30,000 people register on election day as a result of the changes we made in 2018. and 300,000 people registered or updating their registration address in the last 30 days. Michigan used to have a 30-day voter registration cutoff. So all of that work we did in 2018, was about the victory then, but also in preparing to really significantly increase turnout in Michigan this year, given that the margin were so close and are so close in elections, and that every vote matters and every vote counts. And we wanted to make sure that everybody in Michigan was able to make their voices heard.
So Proposition 3 was drafted in an ACLU office. How much did we spend on Proposition 3, Sharon?
I think the total budget was about $5 million for the whole proposal, with the ACLU making the most significant investment.
I think we were over $2.5 million from the headquarters, plus you guys and the affiliate. And the vast reforms that went in place is what you see playing out this week. How many election day registrations were there? 22,000?
So I don't have all the numbers because it's just a few days. But what I can say is that there were 28,000 on election day.
On election
day. And we'll be able to get many more of those numbers.
All right.
And it was a great victory, but we are, here in Michigan, we're having to watch the pushback that we saw at the TCF Center. I was at the TCF Center, and it was disheartening to see individuals trying to disrupt the methodical processing of absentee ballots.
Yeah.
But you all should know that those election workers were not fazed, and they made sure that all those ballots got counted, and were not going to be distracted by those who wanted to disrupt it.
All right, let me ask a question to Victoria before we let the two of you go. So you have a question, Victoria, from Martha from Flagstaff, from your neck of the woods. What can Secretary of State Hobbs do to validate votes? What does all this have to do with marking ballots with Sharpies? And then there's a question from Corrine in Prescott, Arizona. If I donate to the ACLU, does my support go to the ACLU of Arizona as well? I think the last one's an easy one. But first, the question from Martha for Flagstaff. Secretary of State Dobbs, in terms of validating votes, and what is this Sharpie gate that we keep reading about?
Thank you for the question, Martha. Couldn't be an event without a hashtag out of the great state of Arizona. Yes, so there were some complaints filed about the use of Sharpies on ballots. And those complaints were filed. So a complaint was even filed by our state attorney general. I will say our Secretary of State Hobbs and our Maricopa County Recorder's office very quickly dispelled any issues about Sharpies being used for voters to mark their ballots. They affirmed that ballots marked with Sharpies would be counted just like all other votes. The Attorney General for the state of Arizona then acknowledged that this issue is actually a non-issue, and the vote continues to be counted in Arizona.
Right. And then, of course, if she contributes to the ACLU, we share the money. I mean, part of anyone's gift stays in the state where you reside. Some of it comes to the national office where we work, and then some of your money goes back out to the states that can support themselves. So definitely thank you, Victoria. All the support you get is a great investment. Thank you, Victoria. Thank you, Sharon. Ethan in the control booth, I'm gonna drive you crazy. Now we're gonna go to Molly Collins, and we're gonna go to Chantal Stevens. Molly Collins from Wisconsin, Chantal Stevens from North Carolina, and then we've covered all of these bedeviling battleground states.
Telling who, please?
Molly Collins. I feel like I'm playing Red Rover, Red Rover. I see you. She's waving. I call Molly Collins over. She's got the gray backdrop. There you are. And there you are, Chantal. Okay.
Hi.
Hi. Great. You both are sight for sore eyes. Okay, Molly, let's start with Wisconsin. First, how are you? You're doing well?
I'm doing great.
So walk me through, like what we did in Michigan, walk me through the work we did in Wisconsin. We were, you were, those were two states that we prioritized for our Rights for All get out the vote effort. And in Wisconsin, we had fought off this kind of these voter purge efforts in years previous. But walk us through what you did in Wisconsin. Then you have a question from Elizabeth from Appleton. Is my state ready to have a revote? It's a question I think that's on her mind. And then Anya, you have from Milwaukee, are any lessons learned in voter engagement, any surprises? And then I'll turn to Chantal Stevens in North Carolina.
So this year in Wisconsin, our work focused on doing get out the vote work to ensure that people knew how to vote safely during the pandemic, whether it was by mail, early absentee, or on election day. And we targeted historically marginalized voters in key geographies that were less likely to be covered by some of our partner organizations and that were strategic to our long-term legislative plans and work. And we had seven organizers on the ground in places we hadn't had staff before. So we really worked on making sure that voters had the how to vote during the pandemic and then the why they wanted to vote. In terms of Elizabeth's question around whether or not, you know, we need to re-vote in Wisconsin, we won't need to vote again. But after the 72 counties perform their canvasses, they will be, finishing the finalizing, certifying the count. And then if the losing candidate is within 1% of the vote, they can ask for a recount. I think, you know, what I'm pretty confident in is that the recount will find what recounts have in Wisconsin in the past few years, which is that our state election officials are really capable and honest and that our election has integrity. I think one of the things that I was most surprised about to get to the last question was, the election actually went pretty smoothly here in Wisconsin on election day. Yeah. And, you know, we planned for a lot of worst case scenarios, both internally with the ACLU and with a lot of our partner organizations. And we just didn't see it manifest. We did a lot of election observing with our partner organizations and answered over 490 calls to the election protection hotline. But really those calls were not the sort of worst case scenarios that we had all been planning for. So I think process worked well.
Yeah, that's great. Walk me through what you did in terms of trying to turn out the vote in Wisconsin. What types of subgroups did you target? What did you do to try to get people to be engaged with the political process? You didn't tell them who to vote for. You obviously, that's for them to decide. You just wanted them to engage the political process. Walk us through what you actually did.
Well, we wanted to make sure everybody knew how to request an absentee ballot because there was a lot of fear that Wisconsin's a pandemic hotspot right now. There was a lot of fear that people wouldn't come out because they were scared to vote in person on election day. And the absentee process is a little bit complicated. And so we really did a lot of messaging, direct mail, phone calls, texts, social media advertising, Facebook Live town halls. All of those sorts of things to make sure that people really had sort of all the election mechanics. And then we just talked about the issues that we knew people cared about. And we specifically were talking a lot to voters of color, specifically Black and Latinx communities and Indigenous groups here in Wisconsin.
Great. Chantal Stevens, the Executive Director of the ACLU of North Carolina. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I am great. How could I not be well when you're on my team? So North Carolina. So talk to me about what you're seeing in North Carolina. Talk to me about where things stand. Talk to me also about what other races are you watching, right? Because, you know, it's not only about the presidential. The ACLU, as we'll hear from a second from our final two speakers, is deeply concerned about some of the down ballot races that have an impact. So walk us through what you're seeing in North Carolina, Chantal.
Sure.
And what are you seeing?
Great. So we don't actually canvass until November 13th. So we are in this for the long haul. So you'll notice that the races are really close. And so no, a lot of calls haven't been made. And we are really waiting to get to that point, right? So like my colleagues before us who spoke earlier, North Carolina too had a record set in voter turnout, 74.6% of registered voters versus 69% in the last general election. So that's just super impressive. But that means we have a lot of votes that still have to be counted, and we have to get that canvass done. So after a lot of legal wrangling leading up to the election, ballots that were postmarked by 5 p.m. on election day have to be counted as long as they're received by the local county boards of elections by November 12th.
Yep.
And it's really important for us to note that local boards of elections can only count ballots at official meetings. And most of those are scheduled for the 12th. So it's going to take us a little while before we can certify and have those final numbers. Now, there are a few places that expect to receive considerable amount of mail-in ballots, which have official counts take place before then, for instance, in Mecklenburg County, and they're doing so today, but they'll likely have to do so again on the 12th. There are about 116 mail-in ballots remaining, but it's unclear how many of those will be returned by voters and were postmarked by election day, right? And we still have about 40,000, a little bit more than 40,000 provisional ballots outstanding throughout the state. But historically, what we've seen is that only about half of those provisional ballots are accepted.
Uh-huh. So talk to me about Mecklenburg County. Mm-hmm. Wasn't that a place where you did some work either last year or the year before on a, what was it, a sheriff's
race? Sheriff's race, that's
correct. So walk me through the down ticket races, because I want our folks to understand that, mm-hmm. you know, we really do try to educate voters on the important civil liberties and civil rights issues that have to do with the down ticket races. So walk them through, what was that play in Mecklenburg?
Sure. Well, this year we focused on issue-based voter education that would have an impact on criminal and youth justice issues uh-huh. in both Mecklenburg and Wake, because those are our two most populous counties.
Right.
And we focused specifically on school board, right, and county commissioner, because they provide a base of power for future campaigns, including the state's redemption campaign through the Campaign for Smart Justice and defunding the police in urban areas to reinvest in support programs for Black and Brown communities and interrupting the school to prison pipeline, right?
Right.
So in that Wake County Board of Education, candidates in contested races who responded to our candidate scorecards in ways that reflected they were supportive of justice reforms in the county's public schools all won. So that was great, right? And then for the county commissioners in Wake, candidates in contested races who responded in favor of support and transparency and investment in communities over police all won their races. Right. And that's 4 out of 7 districts. And then in Mecklenburg, 3 candidates with the most favorable responses to issue scorecards, all of whom expressed support for removing school resource officers from local schools, they won their contest.
Right.
One of the races that we're definitely paying close attention to is the race for the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. That is extremely close.
Right, with
the race. The current Chief Justice is a Democrat, and she trails her challenger by roughly about 3,700 votes.
Yeah.
And this is a case where provisional ballots and yet to be counted mail-in ballots could decide the race.
Wow.
Now, if the incumbent wins, that Democrats would retain a 5-2 majority in the North Carolina Supreme Court. If she loses, Democrats would have a 4-3 majority.
Wow.
Why we're watching it closely is because with the sheer number of appointments to federal judgeships by the current administration and the current makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, state courts are viewed as an avenue for us to secure many protections for our key issues in the coming years.
And that was a question that we got from one of our listeners, one of our viewers, is saying, what are you doing to pivot as the federal judiciary becomes more conservative and more hostile? It is focusing on these state courts.
State courts,
and that's
exactly
why the composition of the state courts is so important. What, so Chantal, important. What you taught me that I want to share with folks mm-hmm. is that in national elections, when it's always, you're trying to get people off the sidelines mm-hmm. to care, it's the local elections that sometimes are the most motivating, because
right.
people say, well, what, my vote doesn't count, my vote doesn't matter. And yet if you can show them, it really matters in school boards,
exactly.
in sheriff races, in county mm-hmm. races. You get them off the sideline. And so these down ticket races have up ticket impacts as well.
Absolutely.
I never knew that until you schooled me. So
no, I'd highly doubt that, Anthony. But you know, the state court litigation strategy would still be possible even if the incumbent loses.
Yeah.
But things will certainly be tougher, right? But it's not impossible. And so we're still keeping faith and holding on to hope.
Plus, there's civic education. You're actually discussing civil liberties and civil rights in the context of an election. That's what we do. That's what we do. Thank you. Thank you both. Thank you very, very much. Molly, thank you. Chantal, see you on the other side.
November
15th, huh? Wow.
Yes.
Oh, all right. My final two guests, and thank you for your patience. Those are the battleground states. So my final two colleagues are people who work with me in the national office. It is Ronald Newman, the national political director, and his deputy, Tanika Boyd, the deputy national political director in charge of our organizing team. So I think this is, here we are. Tanika's in the orange, Ronnie's in the gray. They're bringing them up. All right, here we are. And I do know that Dale had to hop off the call. So I think we're gonna close this out with the two of my rock stars. These are the folks who are the anchor on our side of the tug of war. Ronnie is the national political director. Tanika is the head of team organizing and is deputy and the deputy political director. Tanika, let me start with you. And I know I skipped over the queue, so I appreciate you rolling with me because I wanted to make sure I got to the battleground states. And now we close it out with you and Ronnie. Talk to us about whether or not I got a question. I got a lot of these, right? A couple, almost over 100, I think, questions. Does the ACLU actively support the idea of eliminating the Electoral College? Maybe this is also for Ronnie. And having the president amplify, having the president simply elected by the popular vote. And then for Tanika, more specifically, I'm sorry, for Tanika, there's a question from Karen from Scottsdale. What can we do to help in Georgia, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Nevada? Almost everyone is asking you, Tanika, what can they do? And could you share with them your thoughts on grassroots mobilization, what's playing out this weekend? Talk to them about the text program you've set up so they can get action alerts. So let's start with Tanika. So first, what can folks do if they're really feeling a little anxious on the sidelines and they want to get out and do something for democracy? What would you suggest for them at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, we want to tell folks that this is how democracy moves forward, right? It's just moving at a snail's pace. And so much of what we will see this weekend is folks engaged in rallies to make sure that every vote is counted across the country. We launched many years ago a network of volunteers who really move ACLU forward, and that it's the lifeline of ACLU, called People Power. And so first and foremost, you can join peoplepower.org, which is our site where you can sign up to get texts, alerts on actions happening this weekend. We're also sending around rallies, and we're supporting our allies and friends who are thinking through what it means to count every vote. The second thing I'll say is also, if folks can text COUNT to 82623, again, that is COUNT to 82623, to make sure that they're signed up for action alerts, to make sure that they know what's happening with ACLU. And we will continue to make sure that every vote is counted. We'll continue to take action because we know that when people take action, democracy prevails.
So there's this woman, Kaya from Farmington Hills, Michigan, asked you a question. Do you think that phone banking and text messages were effective tools to get out the vote?
You're asking an organizer if
I'm
they think
you.
Organizing tactics are effective. Absolutely. Especially, I think we faced a rough year in 2020 as a country. And as a world, right, we went through COVID, we saw massive uprisings this summer of people really protesting around the way they're being policed in their communities, from the death of, you know, Ahmaud Arbery. We saw the murder of George Floyd, Tony McDade, Breonna Taylor. We saw a string of what happened this summer that really triggered folks. And people took to the streets. But we also continue to support in our political advocacy department down ballot races from Maricopa County to supporting work in Michigan, to down in Miami-Dade, to sheriff races in Georgia, using text messaging and calling. And that was really powered by our volunteers. Yeah. We sent over 1 million text messages. We made over 2 million phone calls, and we were really able to deliver on some really important races down ballot.
Another question. If I'm in a blue state where calling my senator won't help, what can I do?
Yeah, you can sign up for on peoplepower.org, because we are taking volunteers from across the country. Our 675,000 activists this year are from all across the country, leaning in to take action in states that still need to have their votes counted. And so we want to make sure that everyone knows that we're watching and we believe that democracy will prevail. So again, sign up to peoplepower.org. I sound like a broken record, to get plugged in, and we will definitely get you a volunteer opportunity that can work out.
And then text COUNT to
826-23.
Yeah. All right, Tanika, thank you very, very much. Thanks for your patience. Ethan, last thing I'm going to do to you to torment you is to swap out Tanika while you bring Dale up here. And then I'm going to ask Ronnie, the National Political Director, a couple of questions while you do that. Thank you, Tanika. See you on the other side. See you tonight.
Dale is no longer on the call. That's not possible.
I think he is. I see him.
No, I'm back. Hi.
Okay.
Ronnie Newman, talk to me about the Electoral College. You're the National Political Director. You're my chief political operative. You're the one in charge of the entire C4 arm of the ACLU. And everyone's scratching their head. Cecily from Sarasota, Florida, appreciates knowing the pros and cons and realities of abandoning the Electoral College. Then you have Paul from Milwaukee, who wants to know what is most likely to happen between now and Inauguration Day if Trump loses. I think we lost Ronnie, but you want to bring him back up on my screen. I'll just ask the question. I think you can hear the questions, right, Ronnie?
Yep, loud and clear.
Okay. So talk to me about those two things, the Electoral College, and what do you think happens in the interim between a defeated Trump and a Biden inauguration?
Of course. And I'm happy to be with the ACLU family on a day like this. On the Electoral College, it's been interesting to see that topic become more prominent in public sort of mainstream conversations. The nice thing about being at the ACLU is that we have opposed the Electoral College since 1969. You know, we identified a long time ago that there were democracy difficulties with that construct, and we have long sought to end it. And our opposition is grounded in the sort of basic principle of one person, one vote, which is retarded a bit by the Electoral College process. One of the interesting things about this cycle is that we've seen turnout at extraordinarily high levels. And one of the nice things about getting rid of the Electoral College is that I think you would actually see turnout spike even further. I think most people on this call recognize that we have these dynamics where if you're in a state that's pretty deeply red or a state that's pretty deeply blue, your county and local elections are still really important. But for elections further up ballot, the effective value of your vote can actually be diminished. And if we can get back to a system that truly hinges on popular vote, we can revitalize the votes of each and every citizen in our country. So those are all reasons to move beyond the Electoral College. The last two things I'll say on that is the sort of direct way to get rid of it through a constitutional amendment is quite hard. You know, we have not made the Constitution very easy to change. So I don't know that that will be the route to a modification. But one thing that has picked up some steam is the National Popular Vote Compact, where certain states have taken the step at a state level to say that their electoral votes will go to the candidate who has the most popular votes. And if you can get a certain critical mass, 270 of states to sign up for that compact, you can effectively move beyond the Electoral College. And so that's something that we've worked on as an institution and hope to get over the hump sooner rather than later.
What are you getting ready for in this interim period where Donald Trump is on his last legs and Joe Biden's coming in as president-elect? What are you worried about? And then also add for me the question I think that Daniel from Montclair must be interloping in our conversations. He wants to know what specific laws are implemented by the Trump administration, is the ACLU going to target for reversal right from the beginning? So those are the conversations you and I have been having all week. So walk me through, what are you worried about in the next couple of months? What are you going to do? What's the first thing you're going to focus on when you have a President Biden and a Vice President Harris?
Okay. So hopefully we will get ourselves, our nation will get a peaceful and orderly transition. And I suspect that Vice President Biden and his transition team will spend the next few weeks gathering information so they know the sort of details and facts that they are stepping into as they move into power. We'll probably learn quite a bit over the coming weeks about personnel and the various actors who will be making decisions in a future Biden administration. And all of that is helpful content for us to know as an institution, because the thing that we will be doing is getting ready. You know, we've worked really, really hard the last few months, and we'll give everybody a couple days to, you know, take a deep breath and rest and relax. And then we'll get back busy, because there's lots of civil rights and civil liberties progress to be made in the next administration when we get there. And we want to be ready to go on day one. And a way to think about our preparation is perhaps in two buckets. There are a range of things that we will be focused upon that are effectively walking back certain policies of the Trump administration that have offended our notions of civil rights and civil liberties. And then there will be another bucket of actions that you might view as true affirmative progress, moving beyond the points that we've been in the past. And so in that first bucket, you can think of things like the Muslim ban that we hope ends immediately. You can think about some of the regulations in categories that we refer to as refusals, where the Trump administration has made it permissible to discriminate against LGBT persons, for instance. You can think about some of the changes in our asylum system, where we've effectively closed the door to vulnerable people seeking refuge within the United States. Those types of things can be changed through executive discretion, through administrative action, and we will be pushing to have those things changed immediately. But there's also forward progress that we need to make as a country. So if you think about the clemency power and the ability to get some of our fellow citizens out of prison, those are actions that a Biden administration can take, and we'll be having conversations with them about that. If you think about LGBTQ rights and the ability to change gender markers on passports and other formal identification documents, those are things that can be done administratively. We'll be focusing upon that. If you think about voting rights, a Biden administration could put a voting rights attorney at every U.S. attorney's office around the country to make sure that all of our citizens can vote with ease and convenience. Changing national standards on use of force, restoring net neutrality, restoring DACA, TPS. We could go on and on. And so we will be locked and loaded and ready to go, assuming we get a new administration to push on some of the civil liberties issues that we care about deeply.
All right. Let me ask you these two last questions, and then I'm going to close up with you and then switch to Dale and then close this out. Talk to Sushil from New Rochelle, who's remarking on the fact that once Biden wins in a polarized and divided America along race lines, he writes, how do we change the narrative and employ a different strategy to protect civil liberties? And then remind folks about the power of the executive branch. Before you came to work with us, you were in the Obama White House, right? So you know better than most just the power of the executive branch. Remind people, even if the Senate is not going to be a hospitable place for a legislative agenda, walk people through what you can accomplish solely within the executive branch. Hope and joy, Ronnie, those are the last two things. You know, how do we get from here to there and give them hope and joy?
Yeah, so on the first point, there's obviously real progress we need to make as a nation in finding more common ground. We will never get to where we need to be with a country that is as polarized as the current country appears to be. And so we've spent a great deal of time in recent years, and we continue to dig in to try to figure out ways to engage our fellow citizens in ways that get us to 60% and 70% and 80% on issues that are important to all of us. And we've learned a bit. There's more to learn, but we've learned a bit. If you think about some of our successes this electoral cycle, you know, we ran a ballot measure in Nebraska that put a ban on predatory payday lending. So Nebraska's, red America, and the ban on payday lending is an issue that we were focused upon because of the racial justice implications of that work. But we found a way to have that conversation. We found a way to talk to voters, and that ballot measure passed on election day at 84%.
Wow,
amazing. We need to do more of that as a nation, and that's what we're really focused upon. To your other question, there's still more counting to do, as you've heard from all of my colleagues, but it is more likely than not at this point that a President Biden will have a Senate that may not be immensely collaborative, may not be immensely cooperative. And so the types of changes that we need to see legislatively may be slow going. But we have a system in which there is a massive amount of power and authority in the administrative regulatory state. And I've talked about some of those areas already. And when you get beyond those, think about the immigrant justice, immigrants' rights space. Much of the decision making in that space is very much held within the executive. There is also a great deal of progress you can make in the area of criminal justice reform, not just through clemency, as I mentioned earlier, but also descheduling of drug possession. We're making progress on those issues, and the executive has certain decision-making authorities there. There are things you can do with public contracting, through the expenditure power. So you should not be discouraged about our ability to make progress in divided government, because, we won't be. We'll be pushing full speed ahead.
Yeah, and what I will say is we say goodbye to Ronnie Newman, and we focus on Dale, and then I'll close it out. My personal way to get a smile on my face is I have come up with a list of dreamers who will occupy Stephen Miller's office in the West Wing. And I have four or five people who I'm going to nominate for that office. We're going to have to do a thorough cleaning of it afterwards, obviously. Dale Ho. The question that people have, the Supreme Court is so conservative. Amy Coney Barrett is now sitting in the seat of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the founder of the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU. Is it all lost? And I thought you would be the best one to give them a sense of hope, since you have an argument coming up before that court on November 30th. So walk us through how you're preparing for this argument, how you've been there before, how you're going there again in less than 3 weeks. No rest for the wicked. I know. I'm sorry. You'll get to rest on the other side. But walk them through how you bring litigation in what is an increasingly hostile or conservative Supreme Court. What are the arguments you're honing?
It's definitely a challenging court to be before, and that was true before Justice Barrett was seated, and it's probably more true now. But I think one thing to keep in mind is that we've been dealing with a conservative Supreme Court for the last 50 years. Notwithstanding some of the conversation in the media sometimes about a swing justice, this or that. I mean, the vast majority of Supreme Court justices who've been appointed over the last 50 years have been appointed by Republican presidents. And the court has been conservative and moving further right over the last five decades. Notwithstanding that, the ACLU has won some tremendous victories before the Supreme Court, including the LGBTQ employment discrimination case last year, which was a 6-3 decision, right? It wasn't 5-4. I argued the case the term before that, successfully preventing the Trump administration from adding a citizenship question to the census. And we're going back in another census case in just about 2.5 weeks. This time trying to prevent the administration from excluding undocumented immigrants altogether from the count that's used to divvy up representation in Congress. And here, in this case, I think we have a very good shot in front of the self-described originalists and textualists on the court, the more conservative members of the court, because all we're asking is for the court to enforce the Constitution according to its plain meaning and the simple words in it, which are that each person in the United States is counted in the census and included in the apportionment for dividing representation in Congress. It doesn't matter if you're a citizen or a non-citizen. It doesn't matter if you're a, if you have legal status or you're undocumented, you're still a person. And that means you count. And I think that's an argument that it would be very difficult for any justice, including the conservatives, and maybe even especially the conservatives and originalists, to walk away from.
All right. I appreciate that very much. So I'll say goodbye to you, Dale. Go back to work. Can't, no rest. Get ready for the Supreme Court argument on November 30th. Appreciate you very much. You've been one of our stalwarts and one of my heroes. Thank you very much, Dale. I'm going to close this out. So look, I'm sorry I'm over time, 21 minutes over time. My bad. I tried so hard to show you the full range of the ACLU across this country and some amazing people who have done, you know, God's work, small g. Forgive me if I needed to kind of show you what keeps me feeling good about this country and feel good about the work. It's my colleagues who just get it done and who work long into the night and work against all odds in some of the most challenging geographies. And I'll leave you with this, my friends. These last 4 years have been hard, definitely hard. But it looks like we're coming out of this period. And we're not there yet. We have work to do. But I want you to think about what the last 4 years would have been like if there had not been an American Civil Liberties Union. Play that scenario in your head. Donald Trump is president. And no ACLU to give him a run for our rights and liberties. No Chantal, no Victoria, no Holly, no Ronnie, no Tanika, no Reggie, no Andrea. I think about what that would have been like. It would have been miserable. So if you are not feeling hope and joy, I think that should help you find it. Stick with us. We're going to need you. The work is not over. There's a massive amount of cleanup we'll have to do. But with you and with all of my colleagues working alongside me, cheek by jowl, failure is not an option. It's just a matter of time. See you on the other side. Be well. Thank you, Ethan, for putting up with me. I know I was a really erratic driver in the car, so I appreciate you rolling with it. And I'll see you all, folks. Have a great evening. Rest well, stay optimistic.